Well, hello, dear friends, and welcome back to the Stand to Reason podcast. This is Tim Barnett filling in for our fearless leader, Greg Kokel. Now, we have a treat for you, okay? You're going to want to hang out with us for the next hour because I can almost guarantee that you are going to learn something. And that's because we have a very special guest. But before we bring him on, I actually want to share with you a true story, okay? So a few years ago, while I was celebrating, while my wife and I were both celebrating our birthdays, they're actually one day apart, which is kind of cool. My daughter, Juliana, who was 6 years old at the time, she got a very quizzical look on her face and she said, "Dad, what does a 1-2 smell like?" Now, I was confused by her question. I said, "Honey, 1 and 2 are numbers, and numbers don't have a smell." Now, technically, she was making a category mistake, but she's 6, so I let it slide. She had this equally perplexed look on her face, and she replied, "No, Dad, what does a 1-2 smell like?" Now, repeating the question didn't help me. Now I was even more confused. I actually didn't know what to say. Then my four-year-old Jocelyn, observing our communication stalemate, she said, "Dad, you look like a monkey and you smell like 1-2. So what's a 1-2 smell like?" All right, here's the point. It's easy for people to talk past each other, okay? We often bring unstated assumptions, ambiguous beliefs, undefined terms into our conversations. We don't always know what's going on inside the other person's head. And all of this makes communication really hard, especially with six-year-olds. It also makes the job of being a pro-life apologist or a pro-life persuader more difficult, okay? And I want to explain how I've had kind of firsthand experience with this more recently. I am really excited right now to be having a conversation with Josh Brom, the president of the Equal Rights Institute. Okay, this is an organization that trains pro-life advocates to think clearly, reason honestly, and argue persuasively. Josh, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Tim. It is such an honor to be on, and I'm just excited to be talking about this with you. I already feel like we are kindred spirits.
Okay. Now, here's the thing. We did get a chance to connect before we had some technical difficulties, which was great because we actually, you know, got to like develop a relationship through it.
Yeah, already.
Which was great.
It happened fast.
Now, I want you, just before we kind of jump into what we're going to be talking about, I would love for you to just tell our audience, who may not be familiar with you and your organization, a little bit about yourself and what you guys do over at the Equal Rights Institute.
Yeah, well, I knew I wanted to be a pro-life speaker when I was 11, which makes me a little bit strange, but basically I heard tapes of Scott Klusendorf speaking, like early Scott, I think even before he was at Stand to Reason. And I knew I wanted to do that when I grew up. I wanted to help end abortion. Like any overzealous homeschooler, I was going to be William Wilberforce when I grew up. So I tell people I was going to be a pro-life speaker when I grew up. Scott ended up being really awesome and mentoring me. And I started pro-life work full-time when I was 21 years old. And then 7 years ago, my brother Tim and I got together. We were going to write a book on dialogue tips. And then we ultimately just started brainstorming what are the things that we want to see happen in the pro-life movement and what are the things that we are passionate about and good at, and we ended up deciding to launch Equal Rights Institute to try to do that. So we like to say that what we try to do is we try to help pro-life people to be less weird and more like Jesus. Like, what would it look like if Jesus talked to a pro-choice person? Like, what would his body language be like? What would he ask? What would he not ask? Yeah. What would it sound like when he made arguments that are grounded in truth but were spoken with gentleness and grace? I basically want to help the whole pro-life movement to get closer to that mark. And so certainly apologetics is a part of this. I grew up on Stand to Reason and Greg Kokel, and they had like just a huge benefit to me. So I love apologetics. I love philosophy, but I also really care about the pro-life movement being more loving and gracious and relational too.
I love that connection to Scott Klusendorf, because actually that's how I mean, just briefly, and we didn't talk about this before, but One of the first presentations I ever put together before I wanted to realize I wanted to be an apologist, you know, was a pro-life presentation. Mm-hmm. And it was based off of something, a talk that I saw online that Scott Klusendorf gave. So nice. This is before I even knew who Stand to Reason was. Uh-huh. And then, of course, following Scott and reading his book, I kind of discovered Stand to Reason and some other work that was going on in this area. And so that's really cool. Now, I'm a little surprised that our paths haven't crossed because we run in some of the same circles. I mentioned to you that I actually met your brother, who is kind of he's a philosopher, right?
And
I know he's influenced the pro-life movement with some of his arguments and articles and this kind of thing. And so we were able, I think, to have lunch at the Evangelical Philosophical Society meeting, which is just a great time to fellowship with brothers and sisters. We're all kind of doing the same work. So we're going to have to get you out to one of those meetings and have a lunch or dinner together or something.
I'd love it.
Now, I said in my opening comments, I mentioned that it was my four-year-old daughter, Jocelyn, right, who came to the rescue to help me understand what my six-year-old was trying to say to me, okay? She acted kind of as the go-between. And that's what I want you to help us with in this conversation because I think that pro-lifers and pro-choicers have a tendency of talking past each other. Oh. We just oftentimes kind of like, what does a 1-2 smell like? We don't really understand what each other is saying. And you know, I've been posting on Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook recently a lot on pro-life arguments, responding to pro-choice arguments. And these videos are getting some traction. And there's been the comments are filled with dialogue, debate, conversation between pro-lifers and pro-choicers. And what I'm noticing is that they're kind of talking past each other. They're not really communicating. And I wanted you to say something about that because I know this is something that you've observed because of your experience. So what's happening? Why are we talking past each other? And why is it so important that we understand each other?
Yeah, boy, that's a great question. So we've been talking about that since we began, of it just feeling like there is such a cultural gap between pro-life and pro-choice people. And it's exactly like what you're talking about. It's like pro-life person says X, but pro-choice person hears Y. Or pro-choice person says A, and pro-life person hears B. And they just completely miss each other in all kinds of the arguments. And sometimes that's because pro-choice people, I think, are being pretty vague with their rhetoric. I know we're going to talk about the my body, my choice thing. It's like that can mean at least four wildly different arguments. So they're not necessarily doing a great job of being precise with what their argument is. And then pro-life people, a lot of times, just do a bad job of asking enough clarification questions and then listening to figure out what they mean. We just kind of assume that they mean what we think that they would mean. And oftentimes that's a straw man. We just think they're saying something really dumb.
Yeah.
Because frankly, we think they're dumb. A lot of pro-life people just think pro-choice people are dumb because we're listening to a lot of sources or pundits on both sides do this, that just talk about the other side as if they're stupid or evil or morally bad or something like that. And so if we're expecting them to be stupid and then we hear them say something that sounds super stupid, then it's like, oh yeah, that adds up. I'm now going to educate you. And what we don't understand is that actually people on the right and the left typically are like psychologically driven by very different things. Mm-hmm. Like this has been shown. So like there's psychological differences. Our drivers are different, which means that we got to work harder at understanding each other and where each other are coming from and what our arguments mean before we can respond and not strawman them.
That's right. Yeah. We're seeing this a lot. I'm over here in Canada. I don't know if I mentioned that. So I'm Canadian. And
nice.
So we're kind of watching U.S. politics, right, from a distance. And you just see in the engagement on the political front is you kind of assume the worst about the person you're talking to, right? Yep. You don't give them the benefit of the doubt. You just assume that, like you said, the arguments are dumb, the person is evil. And so you don't even, you know, if you start there, of course there's going to be trouble communicating with each other.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of mentality, we've all seen it politically, it's in this debate too, where, you know, I approach the person advocating for abortion, and I don't consider their worldview. I just think they must be an idiot. You know, we're gonna see. I think this bodily rights argument, which we'll get to in a minute. There's one aspect of it, and I got to be honest. Like, you know, I have fallen into this category of assuming that if they just knew that it was a separate body or something, then
yeah.
You know, then that would
only
solve
they
this.
Knew if only that they would, saw an ultrasound, then yeah, it would be so easy. Yeah,
then it would end this argument for good. You know, and what we're gonna see is no, that is a naive understanding, and I'll be the first to admit that used to be my understanding.
Yeah, okay? Mine so, too. I've been there too.
So what we're going to try and do is clarify so that we can – the point of this conversation between us is so that we can all have better conversations with pro-choice people, okay? And I think if you hang out with us for the next, you know, few minutes, you're going to see that's the case, okay? Because to be honest, when I started looking into the My Body, My Choice argument, and I went to Google. Okay, I know Sandra Reason's got articles, but what's out there in response to this? And that's why we're talking right now, because one of the first articles or the first videos that popped up was from Equal Rights Institute. I'm like, hey, I recognize that Josh guy. I recognize that name. And so I clicked on the video, and the video was from a number of years ago. And it was you. And I'm telling you, you gave me an education. Okay. Mm-hmm. Here's a guy who has been kind of doing apologetics in general, but interested in pro-life work and reading, you know, Case for Life and Defending Life by Beckwith and so on, different works from pro-lifers. And yet here was this, some of these ideas that I had, frankly, never engaged with, never heard before, or at least you were giving me categories that I hadn't thought about. And so we're going to get into that. But before we talk about the bodily rights, I just want to kind of lay the groundwork here, because there are different kinds of arguments that pro-choicers give, right? And so maybe you could say something about, you know, yeah, the kinds of arguments that are out there, and then we'll kind of move towards the bodily rights one.
Yeah, that's fantastic, because there's really two fundamental disagreements between pro-life and pro-choice people. The disagreements are not whether or not poverty matters, whether or not we care about the issue of rape, like all these different things. Like there's a lot of common ground here. The two fundamental disagreements are fetal personhood. What is the unborn? Does it matter? Is it like you and me? Is it a human person with rights, with equality? And then the other one is bodily autonomy, which is the idea that even if pro-lifers are right about fetal personhood, even if it is a person, maybe they would argue that a woman should have the right to have an abortion because of her bodily autonomy. In other words, that it would be a government overreach to pass a law that controls what women can do with their body or anything that's inside their body, even if it's a person. And this is where pro-lifers often get mixed up, is they hear them saying something like, well, it's dependent on her body. And they want to say, oh, you're saying that it's not a person. You know, I mean, hey, two-year-olds are pretty dependent compared to teenagers. And so, like, that's the problem. You're saying it's not a person. And that's actually rarely what's going on for them. There are occasions, maybe 5% of pro-choice people actually think that the unborn is something like a kidney, is like tantamount to like an organ inside the woman's body. And they need some biological education. And we're happy to give that to them. I don't feel like I even need to help pro-life people to do that. That's like really, really easy. That's the low-hanging fruit.
Yeah.
The more interesting pro-choice people, and almost all the ones that we talk to on college campuses, mean something different. They mean that it doesn't matter if it's a person. They don't necessarily think it's a person. They probably don't. But it's like, it doesn't matter, because it's this more fundamental thing. It is in her body. It is dependent on her body. And she needs the right to control what happens with her body. So she should, you know, and there's multiple versions of that, but that is like a fundamental difference that pro-lifers need to understand. This is not a personhood argument. What is working here, what is doing the heavy lifting, even if they don't say this, is they are conceding, for sake of argument, fetal personhood. Because if they didn't, like, if it's not a person, they don't need a bodily rights argument anyway. But if we're right about the unborn, then a bodily rights argument can still win the day for them. And that's why I think this matters so much to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I went through and read a number of comments in some of these videos that I had posted, and the person would say, my body, my choice, something to that effect.
Yeah.
And then the pro-lifer would come in and they would say, it's not your body. There's right. another body. And then they'd go through, you know, like how many heads does a mother right. have, a pregnant woman have? How many toes? How many fingers? And of course, they're drawing attention to the fact that there's another body inside the mother's body. That's great as far as it goes. But what you're saying is these pro-choice arguments are granting. They're saying, yeah, it is a fully valuable person inside the mother. Guess what? You still get to kill the unborn because of these bodily rights arguments.
Yes.
Okay.
That's exactly.
So that's what's really going on. So you could see why trotting out that kind of explanation where, well, look, it's got a separate DNA. Yeah. And it's not going to be persuasive to this person.
Yeah.
Right. So if you find yourself in that situation where I just went through, like, here's the playbook on right. pro-life arguments. I just made the case that it's a separate, distinct, whole human being. And now they're saying, yeah, they shrug their shoulders and say, yeah. And it's the mother, and it's the mother's choice. It's her right. Bodily autonomy. And now what do we do? Okay, so this is where I hope people are tracking with us here, because what we're about to talk about is, Kate, the next step. Okay, so maybe you tried this and you saw this didn't work. You know, the person agreed with me, but they didn't change their mind. What we want to do is now talk about, okay, they're making the my body, my choice argument, the bodily rights argument. Here are some ways that you can respond. Yeah. And let me tell you something. Josh has been doing this a number of years. He's been in discussion, conversations, hundreds, even thousands of conversations with people who don't agree with him. And so they've tried these arguments out. They know what works and what doesn't. And what's interesting is we're going to get to this a little bit later. I thought we were going to talk about a particular argument that I saw in his video from like 7 years ago. Uh-huh. And he said, actually, Tim, that we don't use that argument anymore. Not very often. We've actually right. improved the argument. So, I mean, we'll get to that point, but I just want you audience to hear that we're talking about like staying with what is the culture? What is the most popular, the best pro-choice arguments of today? Not 20 years ago, not 10 years ago. Like we're talking today. Yeah. That's what Josh is going to help us with. So let's talk about bodily rights arguments. Okay. Yes. What's a bodily rights argument? And like, what are the different categories that you have set up?
Yeah. So that's kind of the next step here is to understand that there's different categories. And this is, and I've got to tip my hat to my friend Trent Horn. The best thing that he's ever done for the pro-life movement is to recognize that there are two different kinds of bodily rights arguments. And so, and we need to respond differently to each one sometimes. So the sovereign zone view is the more extreme pro-choice argument. It's also easier to refute. But it basically says that a woman can do whatever she wants with anything inside of her body. But she can do whatever she... So in other words, like it's like her body's like a sovereign zone. They will never use that mm-hmm. phrase, by the way, unless they've listened to Trent. But okay. It's like you can't usually kill people, right? But if they're in your body, then the rules change. And there's a lot of different ways to respond to that, but I'll tell you the one that I always start with is to just demonstrate that this is inherently an extremist argument. Because, yeah, I've talked to over 1,000 pro-choice people. Our founding staff have had conversations with over 5,000 pro-choice people, always trying to figure out what's working and what's not working. Not just what is true, but what is persuasive right now. And as we've gone through that process, we've seen that some things just work better than others. And as we talk to people about, okay, look, most pro-choice people we can find a lot of common ground with. Most pro-choice people think that late-term abortions are wrong. So wrong, they should be against the law. Most pro-choice mm-hmm. people think that sex selection abortion is so wrong, it should be against the law. They usually think abortion is bad, that it hurts people, that it should happen less often. There are certainly exceptions, okay? There's a certain wing that is getting even more extreme, I think, out of fear. They're freaked out about Texas and the Supreme Court. Okay, I get all that. Mm. But most pro-choice people want to see themselves kind of more in the middle of the road, a quote-unquote nuanced view, right? And so then all I've got to demonstrate is that the way they're grounding their pro-choice argument by saying she can do whatever she wants with anything inside of her body means there should be zero restrictions on abortion. Like, you can't say, on one hand, yeah, we should ban third trimester abortions, and then at the same time say a woman should be able to do whatever she wants with anything inside of her body. Because where's the baby in the third trimester? It's still in her body. And so it's like, you got to pick one. And I have seen people abandon bodily rights arguments altogether when they hear that because they don't want to be an extremist. Mm-hmm. I've seen other people jump and they'll make a personhood argument instead. It's like, okay, well, then we'll talk about that. Or what they might do is they might make a better bodily rights argument that Trent calls their right to refuse argument. There's a few that'll just bite the bullet and be like, okay, you're right. I should accept all the abortions. But even in that case, I'll just say, they are better off. We had that happen one time to me on a campus where I made this argument, and this young woman was basically like, the light bulb went off for her. And she's like, you're right. I shouldn't be against any abortions. Well, I've got to go to class. Goodbye. And she walked away. And I'm like, wait, I wasn't finished. You know, like that kind of thing. And we, in our staff conversation away from outreach, that was at Aquinas College in Michigan, as we left, the topic of conversation our staff had was she better or worse off for having met me? Because it's like I seemingly made her more pro-choice by the end of this.
Yeah.
And our view is that she is better off because mm-hmm. she walked up to our outreach table with a inconsistent but comfortable pro-choice position. And she walked away with a consistent but super uncomfortable pro-choice position. And we want to drive the uncomfortable pro-choice position extinct.
Yeah, that totally makes sense to me. You've now given her something to think about. It's the stone in the shoe idea.
The pebble in the shoe thing. Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And so she's walking away. She's like uncomfortable with something that now she has admitted she holds to.
Yes.
And whether it's abortion at 9 months, whether it's sex selective abortion. So for those maybe unfamiliar, this is going on. This is where, hey, I find out through an ultrasound that I'm having a girl and I don't want a girl. I want a boy. And so you have an abortion based on gender, based on sex. You could trot out, and what do you think of this? What about a woman? So I'm just going to maybe role play this or maybe see if I'm doing this right. So I am talking with a pro-choicer and I ask them, let's suppose a white woman is pregnant with a mixed race son, okay? And because she slept with a black man or something. But she doesn't want a mixed race, she wants a white son. And of course we think that's horrible. That's what she wants. It's her body. And so would we think it's appropriate for her to get justified that she get an abortion for the reason that her kid has the wrong skin color? She doesn't want that skin color. And I think most of us would say, especially today, you know, with everything going on in the culture, we say, this is just like so wrong. Yeah. But we want the person, if they're going to be consistent on this view, we might call this the extreme, the extreme pro-choice view, which is really hard to sit with. I mean, this is what's so cool about this argument that that we're using here. It's a reductio ad absurdum. What we're trying to do is say, look, we want you to take your view for a test drive. Okay? So it's first trimester, you just think it's a clump of cells, or even if you think it's a person, whatever, the person just is okay with it. Okay, now let's take your view for this drive, you know, where it's 9 months, or it's sex selective, or it's based on race, or something like that. That doesn't sit so comfortably. Yeah. So I totally, I'm with you. I think that person left better off because not only is their view consistent, but it's like unlivable, you know? How do you sleep at night holding that view? Right. So good for you. Now, you actually, do you still use the thalidomide example?
Yeah,
in this,
a twist. Yeah,
okay.
So I don't start there. We start with talking about the extremism thing that if this is true, if we take this roof off, for example, then all abortions ought to be legal. And if they bite that bullet, right? If they like, okay, but I still think this is like, okay, fine. If they just accept that, okay, all the abortions ought to be legal then. Then thalidomide is the next thing I would try. And we're not the first ones to talk about that. Dr. Rich Papard, who now has done a lot of work with Scott Klusendorf at LTI, he's the first one, I think, to use thalidomide in a pro-life argument. But basically, so like for those who don't know, thalidomide is this really tragic story from the last century of medical history where in the late 50s, early 60s, mainly in Europe, for a little while, pregnant women were being given thalidomide to treat severe morning sickness, thinking that maybe this would be an option that would be more helpful than the other alternatives. And what the medical community didn't know for several years, that there was a cause and effect relationship between, if you give a pregnant woman thalidomide, her baby will either die or will be born with severe birth defects, like without arms and or legs. And so, of course, once they figured that out, they pulled it. You can't get it if you're pregnant. But as Rosa Parks said, like, it just seems weird to say you can do anything you want with anything inside of your body, but then also say a woman shouldn't be able to take thalidomide. Like, what if a woman? You've got to kind of paint the thought experiment in a realistic way here. So it's kind of like, well, let's say a woman has severe morning sickness. She's tried all the other things. Nothing's working. Her husband's a doctor, though, so he can get a hold of thalidomide as he just convinces him, look, I've got to try this. But they know what it will do. Mm-hmm. Most pro-choice people feel icky about that because they haven't trained their moral compass otherwise. Like, a lot of people, like, we have convinced ourselves of what we want to believe, right? Like, over the course of years sometimes. But no one in this universe has spent time, like, training their moral compass to be for pregnant women taking thalidomide. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes that's enough to kind of turn and be like, oh, because it puts them in a weird place of saying, no, she shouldn't take thalidomide because it seems wrong to cause birth defects. But they're supporting, what, dismemberment abortions? That's a little bit weird. And then the twist that we added to this was for people who bite that bullet is to ask, well, what if she intentionally was trying to deform her child? If this is a worse woman? And again, like, we'll always give the caveat. This is not what we think women having abortions are like. But what if? This is a thought experiment. What if the woman from the last thought experiment, so let's say the first time she gave birth to a baby without legs, and then later she becomes pregnant again, and she's having a much better pregnancy experience, but she just thinks it would be really unfair to have a perfect baby now. And so she takes thalidomide again to intentionally deform her baby. We found some people won't bite that bullet, but they'll bite the first one. So we're just trying to figure out how to access their conscience, their intuition.
Yeah.
And ultimately, see, can we get them? And a lot of times at this point, they will jump to a right to refuse argument, which is just a better, more interesting pro-choice argument.
Yeah. Okay. So before we get there, just so everyone's with us, the sovereign zone argument, I have an absolute right to bodily autonomy. That's the claim. Okay. That's one kind of claim. And we're going to make them go in two different directions, hopefully, with our questions. Either they're going to become they'll see how extreme their view is. They'll become mm-hmm. uncomfortable, hopefully, with where their view takes them. That is 9 months, it's okay to abort, thalidomide. I mean, all these different, so you give all those examples. Then there is another direction, and that is they may end up going towards a personhood argument, which is a different kind of argument. So you either move them towards one extreme, or they abandon the sovereign zone argument altogether and try to do a personhood kind of argument, which is, again, we started talking about that. That's a different kind of thing. Yeah. Now we're talking about whether or not the unborn is a valuable person, different thing.
Yeah.
But now what you're saying is some will abandon maybe the sovereign zone argument, or maybe not even go there. They'll make a different kind of bodily autonomy argument. It's more sophisticated. Would you say it's probably the best argument for the pro-choice position?
It's getting there.
Okay,
getting there. There's a twist on it that can make it better, but we won't start with the super, super advanced. We'll take it like the next level.
So where we're going to go, just so people hang in with us, we are going to talk about what you think is the best argument. Like, when we finally get there, the best pro-choice argument, and we're going to talk about how to answer it, okay?
Yes.
So let's talk about right to refuse arguments. You mentioned that. So sovereign zone, we talked about how to navigate that. Now we're doing right to refuse. What is it? How do we respond?
This argument merely says that a woman has the right to refuse to have her body used as a life support machine. She doesn't necessarily have the right to do whatever she wants with her body. Maybe there are some things she can't do with her body, but one thing she should definitely have the legal right to do is to refuse to have it used as life support. So this is where the famous violinist thought experiment comes in, where you wake up in a hospital bed and there's a tube coming out of your body connected to the patient in the bed next to you. He's in a coma. The head of the hospital rushes in and says, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. He's a world famous violinist with a kidney problem. You were kidnapped by the Society of Music Lovers and they figured out you're a kidney match, so they kidnapped you, they hooked you up, and then they left you here. And I'm really sorry about this. This is super messed up. But the violinist is a person with a right to life. And if we unplug you, he'll die. The good news is you only have to be here for 9 months. And so, and then he'll become viable and you guys can kind of go your merry ways. And Judith Jarvis Thompson, the pro-choice philosopher who came up with this, says, well, that's a lot like pregnancy, where even if pro-lifers are right that it is a person, like the violinist is, can't we all agree that we shouldn't there shouldn't be like a violinist amendment to the Constitution? We shouldn't be able to handcuff you to the bed. We can have discussions about whether it is a, you know, morally obligatory thing to stay. Most people would say it's not. They would say it's a supererogatory act, like it's a morally laudable above and beyond the call of duty kind of thing to stay. Most people are going to agree we should certainly not be handcuffing people to the bed in that case. And so she's like, yeah, so pro-lifers, even if you think abortion is wrong, it should be legal. So this is a right to refuse argument. And the first place that I want to go here, there's like a lot of different ways that pro-life people respond to this that I think are not terribly persuasive. But I think the most persuasive place to start is called the responsibility objection.
Okay.
Which says that when you have consensual sex, you're engaging in an act that you know might result in the creation of an inherently needy child that you owe compensation to. So here's a quick thought experiment to explain that. We think this comes from Beckwith. We're not positive, but Scott thinks it's a Beckwith thing, so we're going to call this a Beckwith thing. But imagine a room with a baby-making machine in it. There's a button on it, and if you push the button, you have a very pleasurable experience. Every once in a while, though, a baby comes out of chute at the bottom, okay? So we've simplified pregnancy. We're all on board. Okay. So imagine a guy goes up to the baby-making machine. He wants a pleasurable experience. He really does not want a baby to come out. So he's gambling. He's rolling the dice from his perspective. Does not want a quiverful or something like that, right?
Yeah.
Okay, but he pushes the button, and wouldn't you know it, a baby does come out the chute. Mm. It seems obvious to even a lot of pro-choice people that he can't just walk away and leave the baby to starve to death, and that he certainly can't directly kill it by, like, bashing its brains in. Why? Well, because it seems morally relevant that he pushed the button. In other words, he engaged in an act that he knew might result in the creation of an inherently needy child that he owes compensation to, which means he needs to either care for this child now or transfer that care to someone else. I think this is really, really strong. Even Michael Tooley, he's one of the smartest pro-choice philosophers in the world. I saw him say in a video debate one time that he doesn't even use bodily rights arguments in his pro-choice work because he says the responsibility objection crushes the violinist.
Wow.
So this is very, very powerful and can convince a pro-choice person that 99% of the abortions ought to be against the law if you convince them of this argument.
Yeah.
The reason we can't stop here is pretty obvious to everyone listening. There's still 1% of abortions left.
Yeah.
That the responsibility objection doesn't touch. And so when a pro-choice person combines this right to refuse idea with the case of rape, that, I believe, is the most powerful pro-choice argument at a philosophical level. And we call this the right to refuse in the case of rape, the triple R argument, because a lot of the pro-life responses don't work at that point, including the responsibility objection. You need something else.
Yeah. Okay, just so people are with us, what this argument, so the famous violinist analogy is an argument through analogy, okay? So what Judith Jarvis Thompson is trying to do is create this analogy to pregnancy and show that in this case, see, it's morally permissible to refuse. Therefore, in the case of pregnancy, it is appropriate to refuse to help the baby, you know, the right to refuse.
Right.
And what we're trying to do, what you're trying to do with the responsibility objection, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but you're trying to show that the analogy isn't analogous. You're trying to point to a position, a point in the analogy. And I think what we're pointing to is the kidnapping part.
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
So you've kidnapped in the illustration, there's someone being kidnapped, right? Of course, they didn't have anything to do with being ending up in this situation.
It's not usually how pregnancy begins.
No, it's not. It's not. And so we're saying, look, in this analogy doesn't work here. When it comes to pregnancy, there is a responsibility. well, what's the response? Well, and then you, I love the baby making machine analogy because it's so, I mean, it's, yeah, push the button, pleasure, right? So there is some kind of reward, but we all know, I mean, everybody knows this is how babies are made. All right. If you don't know, go ask your parents. Okay. Birds and the bees stuff. And so a baby could result. And so there's certainly going to be some compensation, some care that's needed. Okay. I love it. Okay. So now, the mother of all challenges to the pro-life position, right to refuse. And now you just lost your best, okay, the responsibility objection. That's what we use to destroy the analogy, okay, to make just show that it doesn't work. But rape is not consensual.
Yeah.
So the baby-making machine illustration it's not going to help us. So how, Josh, do we navigate this?
Yeah. So I'll tell you what we used to do is we used to focus on what we would call an obligation to help approach. Okay. That basically said that there are some cases where even if it's not your fault that you're in the situation, that you have an obligation to help. Like if you are the only adult in the geographic vicinity of a child and you are the only one that can help them not die with basic care, like food and shelter, then you have this obligation. So Steve Wagner, who used to be a Stand to Reason, and myself, my brother Tim, Trent Horn, and a few others all worked together on this paper. This is like nine years ago, called The De Facto Guardian. And it's a really fun paper. If you're into pro-life philosophy, Google it. You can still find it. And it's really, and it was just working for like 2 years trying to figure out how do we solve this problem? If we tie all the pro-life hands behind our back, how do we still participate in the fight? And it's interesting, and we have seen some pro-choice people change their mind as a result. So there's a lot of thought experiments in there trying to get at that. Ultimately, though, we're not using the argument as much now at ERI because we found a different approach that we think works better. And again, for us, I don't care whether the argument is true. I want to know that it's also persuasive. Is it connecting with young pro-choice minds? And there's some pro-life arguments from 20 years ago, by the way, that still do connect with young pro-choice minds. So I don't want to just like reinvent the wheel for the sake of reinventing the wheel. I just want to figure out what's working right now. Sometimes culture does change, even though truth never changes, right?
Yeah.
And so what we have, what we tried shifting to this other approach, which is not an obligation to help approach. It's an obligation to not kill people approach. In the end, that's what's doing the work, is you have an obligation. It doesn't bother arguing for when you're obligated to help people. It says that you never have the right to intentionally kill innocent babies. And so what's important here, one of the important details here is how abortions happen. And I'm intentionally as kind of non-graphic as I can be with something like this. But unfortunately, in a case like this, the details matter. And so I'll just say, you know, briefly, I have an attitude for post-abortive people that is very different than a lot of people would expect. I think there's a lot of reason to have so much grace and empathy for women who have had abortions because there's this problem that happens. This is like, there's a quick tangent, but if we're pro-life and pro-choice people talking past each other, here's a thing where we talk past each other sometimes. When we trot out toddlers, which is a thing that we teach too, Stand to Reason, ERI, we still, trotting out a toddler is still a really viable thing to do. Mm-hmm. The problem is when we trot out toddlers, sometimes they can come across to pro-choice people that we think that women having abortions are just like a woman who would like kill her toddler, like drown her toddler in the tub. And it's different. Moral culpability is much more complicated than that, right? You're thinking about what does the person know? So there's an epistemological question. What do they know? What should they be expected to know? And also, what do they intend? And I don't think most women having abortions are at all parallel to a woman who would drown her toddler in the tub. So I don't get into abortion descriptions to, you know, heap shame upon people who have done this because I don't think they knew better, typically speaking. But unfortunately, if we're going to respond to the toughest philosophical pro-choice arguments, we can't just respond with graphic images. We can't just respond with emotional arguments. We got to meet them where they're at philosophy. So the way abortions work is we're talking about sometimes suffocating babies through a chemical abortion. We're talking about dismembering babies sometimes. And we're talking about lethal injections sometimes, which is what we're doing in later terms. And no one would say if you did any of those things to a toddler that you'd have just refused to help them. So I think the most helpful thing that I can say about this, that I've seen really help people, like this light bulb goes off for people, is here's a reason Pro-Choice people are confused about pregnancy. It's because there are a lot of cases where you have three options, where you can help, not help, or kill. So Tim, let's say you told me after the show, hey, I've got a kidney issue. I was hoping you would be willing. Hey, we're both pro-life apologists. You know, there's this brotherhood kind of thing, right?
There you go.
So I need you to donate your kidney to me so I can live. Mm-hmm. I have three options. I can help Tim by donating my kidney. I cannot help Tim by choosing not to donate my kidney. I have a third option, too. I could directly kill you. I could be like so codependent and uncomfortable with the idea of you even knowing that I'm not going to donate my kidney to you that I shoot you, right? Mm-hmm. Those are three distinct options.
Yeah.
In pregnancy, you don't have all three of those options. You only have two. You can either help by carrying to term or you can kill. So it's more, and this is where we use an analogy that I think is more analogous to pregnancy than the violinist. Imagine you take your boat out. And you just like for a joyride, you're a couple of hours from shore. And then you realize a 10-year-old stranger kid was hiding on your boat when you left. You had no idea. He was playing hide and seek at the docks with his parents. He's pretty dumb. He hid on the stranger's boat. And now you see him. He's here. This is a case like pregnancy. You have two options. You can help him by driving back to shore and helping him find his parents. Or you can throw him overboard. But you don't just have like this supposedly neutral don't help approach. I've seen one pro-choice person try to respond to this by saying, oh, no, you've got to not help. Just like toss him in the water. Maybe he can swim back to shore. No, he's not going to make it. It's not like the end of the scene of Jaws. Like he's going to die. He's going to drown or he's shark food. Like at this point, like it's not going to work. So those are your only two options. And when you explain it to people like that, then they can see the problem with the violinist argument is that it pretends like having an abortion is just choosing to not help a sick person. Mm. And what it's actually doing is it's directly killing a healthy person.
Wow. So now, we've bypassed the responsibility part and we're drawing our attention to something that's amiss in the analogy itself. And that is, it makes it seem like by refusing, you're just not helping. But that's not the case at all. There's an active, it's not passive. Abortion is an active process. Now, I've actually heard in response, just in my own dialogue, that, you know, and this may be the person just didn't understand how abortion works. And this goes to your point about being a little more descriptive. But they said, no, you're just removing. You're just removing the embryo or the fetus from the womb. It's not actively killing. What would you say in response to that?
I would say, sure, you're removing the baby, but after you've killed it.
Yeah.
So the most confusing part of this is RU486, because a lot of people think of in fact, for a while, I thought of RU486 as analogous to merely unplugging. And then I talked to a doctor and we looked into a physiology textbook that basically explained that the way the first pill works in chemical abortions is it detaches the baby from the placenta. So you functionally are suffocating it. It's more like smothering a toddler or throwing a toddler overboard on a boat. And wow. So it's like, hey, that's still direct killing. It might seem a little bit less direct than, you know, like a dismemberment abortion. And this is where sometimes philosophy gets tricky. So like direct versus indirect killing. And I agree that there are some cases that are tricky. I agree that trolley cases are hard to figure out what our intuitions ought to be sometimes. But I would say you can have direct killing, but there can still be a gradient. So for example, so Tim, you're going to be the victim in my thought experiment again. If you and I went scuba diving and I took your scuba mask and you drowned, that would be less direct than if I killed you by bashing your head in with a rock a bunch of times.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say, even though the scuba diving thing was less direct, it's still direct killing. And that's what I think RU486 is.
Okay. Yeah, that's a helpful illustration there. And I hope our listeners can see that we're using these illustrations. They're hypotheticals, they're thought experiments. And again, I think you mentioned this, we're trying to almost I'm thinking of the word, not vivify. Like, we're trying to like show that instigator, maybe you can help me with the word I'm looking for. You're trying to get their conscience to understand.
We're trying to get in touch with their conscience. If their conscience is kind of, if they think of abortion as merely unplugging or making someone unpregnant, then they need to understand that that abortion is more than that. And they can bite the bullet. They can be like, okay, I accept exactly what, like David Boone does this. He will accept exactly what abortion does and say, I still think philosophically it ought to be legal. But you definitely don't want pro-choice people to be like, oh no, abortion is basically like just like making a baby disappear. It's like, no, it's unfortunately it's more than that.
Yeah. And it turns out that getting the facts will help inform the kind of moral equation, right? And this is oftentimes, you know, when you're talking with someone and they don't think it's a human being or something like that, when you start to present those facts, then the light bulb goes on morally. Oh, okay. That's why this is wrong. Okay. Now I understand. Of course, in this case, they're fully granting that it's a person. Okay, now we're trying to turn the light bulb on even still, okay, and to show that their argument doesn't work. So certainly that's the goal in these kind of thought experiments. Yeah. I know they might sound like, oh, you guys are just being so philosophical. No, you have used these like on the university campus to help people kind of, okay, let's get out of the pro-life, pro-choice abortion thing just for a second, and let's talk about this over here.
Yeah.
You know, let's talk about going out on a boat, you know, and there's this toddler or whatever hiding. Yeah. And that kind of awakens our moral intuition, I think, on some of these issues, helps figure this stuff out. Okay, so before we – do you have anything else you want to say about bodily rights, bodily autonomy before – because I do want to ask you kind of in the last kind of 10 minutes here just about – helpful advice, you know.
I'll say one other thing.
So okay,
Here's like a practical tip, like a tactic. And this is where one of Greg's tactics is really useful. You and I were talking about this before the show. At this point in the dialogue, a lot of times what happens, it's not that pro-choice people are trying to be difficult necessarily, but a lot of times they will ping pong in the conversation back and forth between personhood arguments and bodily rights arguments.
Mm-hmm.
And they're two very different things. And it's just like sometimes like they just don't want to lose and they're kind of grasping at straws. They might not have thought about this as much as you have, as anyone who listens to Stand to Reason, you've probably thought about this more than they have. And so they'll start to lose on personhood and they'll jump and make a bodily rights argument. Then you might start waning on that and then they'll be like, well, it's not a person anyway. And then like jumps back to that. And because it's really a tricky thing to navigate. And this is where narrating the debate is super helpful. This is where I'm going to be like, okay, let's pause. Let's have this like little meta moment. And here's what I see happening. I feel like there's these two big disagreements between us.
Yeah.
And they're both really important. And by the way, you only need to win on one of these for pro-choice to win. Like, I've got to win on both, right?
Yeah.
And so I just want us to pick one and camp there for a while because we're just like, they're both hard. And we're not going to get anywhere if we bounce back and forth every 2 minutes. So pick whichever one you want. It's up to you. But can we try camp in one of these two places and talk about that, maybe even get to where we've got common ground. And even if I convince you that I'm right on one of them, it's okay. Then we can try the other thing. Maybe you'll win on the other one and it's fine, but let's try to do that. So that's a thing that happens a lot in these conversations and it's hard for pro-life people to navigate. But if they jump to a person argument, I encourage people to check out our YouTube channel. We've got a video that we made with Karenette on the equal rights argument, which we have found is the number one argument has changed more pro-choice minds in front of us than any other argument. It's not the way pro-life people typically talk about personhood, but it's one of those things where like we tried a thing that was different than we used to use and we were stunned at the results. Almost every time we see a pro-choice person change their mind at an outreach is because we use the equal rights argument. So I love people like learn how to use that argument. It's one of the reasons we started Equal Rights Institute in the first place. We wanted to teach people, here's how to use this argument and change pro-choice minds about fetal personhood.
Okay, so that was a tease right there. Okay, so what? First of all, what's your YouTube channel? So where can we find that video?
If you look up on YouTube, Equal Rights Institute, you'll find our channel.
Okay.
There's podcasts you can also find on the website. There's online courses. There's a blog with a couple of hundred articles. But yes, there's a YouTube channel. And we've got it's kind of like a PragerU style video that we partnered with on Karenette. It's about 10 minutes long where we explained what the equal rights argument is.
Now, do you have time to get into it here? I know we got 7 minutes. So
I could do it in 7 minutes.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, because you, I mean, now I'm curious. Okay.
I know, right?
Okay.
So, here's what I'm doing. So, and this is what I get into if I'm like at a high school. If I'm speaking at a high school, I want them to know. It's like, here's the main reason I'm pro-life. I know a bunch of you are pro-choice. I just want you to hear the main reason I'm pro-life, because it's not a religious reason, and it's not an emotional one. I'm not pro-life for emotional reasons. I don't get the warm fuzzies when I look at a picture of a zygote. I'm sorry, pro-lifers. It does nothing for my heartstrings. My heartstrings go to the woman, frankly. And so the reason I'm pro-life is because I'm starting with equality as that's what's going on. If you dig down into my metaphysical basement, we're all starting with some intuition. That's the one I'm starting with. It's one that pro-choice people are starting with too. We care more about equality than like anything else. So it seems really obvious that human adults have an equal right to life or an equal protection from violence, which is, and I'll ask them about like, can we agree, like, we agree that Black people have an equal right to life, right? And they're like, yeah, okay, definitely. Do we agree gay people have an equal protection from violence? Yes, okay, I'm glad we agree. You can also throw in some humor here, which is really great for pro-life people to bring humor into their conversation. Like, sure. What about, like, Nickelback? Like, should Nickelback have an equal right to life in spite of the music that they make? Or, like, pick a hated band, a sports rival team in your city, whatever. And, like, it doesn't even have to be that funny. The fact that you're trying to be funny is actually doing most of the lifting here.
Sure.
But, like, you just, like, throw in, like, okay, we all agree. Okay, so human adults, we agree about human adults. What about human newborns? Can we agree that human newborns should have an equal protection from violence? And most people agree. There's, like, four philosophers who disagree. But most people are on the same page on newborns. And then I'm going to throw them a curveball. What about squirrels? Like, seriously, like, do you think squirrels should be in the equal protection from violence circle? Like, imagine a circle where everything inside of it has that equal protection. Are squirrels in the circle? I don't think we should just, like, go around kicking random squirrels. But I don't think that they're equal to us. And so we can have that little conversation. Like, I think if 50 elephants got rounded up in a field and slaughtered, I think they'd be really wrong. Mm-hmm. But I think it'd be more wrong if 50 humans got rounded up in that same field and slaughtered, right? And so I can have that conversation with an animal rights activist. But typically, we're going to find that common ground. We agree that human adults and newborns are in, and we agree that squirrels are out. So the question is, what is the thing that we have in common that explains that equality? Notice I'm not talking about the unborn yet. I am intentionally taking a break. We are treating the unborn as an unclear case. We're talking about clear cases right now.
Yeah.
And so they might say something like, well, I think you need to be sentient to be it. Okay, let's talk about that. So usually when they say sentience, they mean this like minimal awareness of the world around them. Okay, well, the problem is squirrels are sentient. Squirrels are super sentient. They're like, I was reading up about a certain species of squirrel recently because I'm fun that way. And I found out that they will store nuts over like a 7-acre area, like all over the place, like all like these little hidden caches of nuts to try to protect them from predators. That's super sentient squirrel. Mm-hmm. I don't think that they're in the circle. I don't think it's as wrong to kill them as it is to kill toddlers. Okay.
Yeah.
They might shift to a different thing, a more advanced thing, like self-awareness. Okay, let's talk about self-awareness. And if let's just assume we need something like being able to know that you exist over a period of time. You're this unique entity, right? You understand that cognitively. Well, the problem is, newborns are out of the circle now. Because newborns can't do that. Mm-hmm. And so it's like they can't find an option that ends up making sense. So then inevitably they'll ask, what do you think it is? Well, and I'll start with a fairly imprecise, simplistic answer for their sake, because it's the best that we've found to help them. I think it's something like human nature. Mm. I think that's the thing. That answer makes more sense of our intuitions than all the pro-choice arguments. Because then human adults and newborns are obviously in and squirrels are out. I think it's something like human nature. If you want to get really philosophical and nerdy, like the typical standard reason audience, buy our Equip for Life course. I've got an entire hour-long advanced module. If you want to know how to get really, really deep into talking about exactly what is a person, how that relates to Imago Dei and all of that. But I don't get into that with 99% of pro-choice people because it's not helpful. And I'll tell you, explaining this to pro-choice people, it's just light bulbs come on. Mm-hmm. And it's like I'm making them choose between being a pro-equality person and a pro-choice person.
Yeah.
And they would rather be a pro-equality person. And so then they become pro-life.
That you're using the language of, the other side, you're talking about, you're being inclusive to the entire human community. It's about equality. And these are all virtues. I like it. And so wait, you said, okay, you mentioned a course.
Yes.
And because I know there's lots of Stand to Reason listeners who'd be into like, let's go deep. You know, I want to buy this course. Where do we get that?
Yeah, if you want a systematic course to the practical dialogue tips to the pro-life arguments that we found to work better than anything else, and that's called the Equip for Life course. If you go to EqualRightsInstitute.com, you can find it. We also have its own website at EquippedCourse.com. But it's 5 hours. It's videos. You can download the audios. You get to be in a private Facebook group and ask us questions. You get access to exclusive podcasts. There's a workbook that's like over 100 pages long that'll help you do this with groups. That was made for people who want to just catch up on what we've been learning as we do our R&D kind of lab work on college campuses.
Okay, and for people who are following along in the podcast, I'm told that it's all going to be in the show notes, so people can click on links and they can find you there. Okay, we got maybe a minute left here, so we can't. I mean, I wish I had another hour to talk to you.
Need to do this again sometime.
Yeah, really. And so I want to say, Josh, that I've really enjoyed our conversation together.
Thank you.
On behalf of myself, Stand to Reason, and our listeners, I mean, you are doing work that is very difficult, okay? I just kind of dabble in it with a few videos or articles here and there, and it is like the other side can be aggressive. I can't tell you, I can't share with my wife the messages I get, like the direct messages that I get from people who don't even know me, and yet it is just hostile, and toxic. And you mentioned kind of off air that being a pro-life apologist, man, it's not an easy thing to do. And there's sometimes a shelf life, where people just, need to step away for a little bit because it can be so difficult. So, our listeners, if they go to Equal Rights Institute, they can find you on your website, your articles, YouTube,
all the things,
all the social media stuff. Well, this has been so good.
Thank you,
Tim. I got to go back and listen because this was so good. Friends, I hope that you enjoyed this discussion and that you will actually put what we learned today into practice. Okay, that's really important. We want to try this stuff out. Thank you for tuning in. And as Greg always says, give them heaven.